12 Who Shaped San Diego, a series of radio programs on local history, biographies of 12 great men and women who have left their mark on today's San Diego.
She was such a character that everybody knew her. Nobody was born or married or died without Kate Sessions furnishing flowers. And if anyone built a home, why, she was the one who furnished the landscaping. And so her name was just became synonymous with horticulture and flowers in San Diego.
It was a time when women were not even expected to go to college, and a woman was hardly encouraged to study science. But Kate Sessions pursued a successful career in the field of horticulture, and her life's work, her plantings, and the plants she introduced into San Diego that thrive in our climate, have immeasurably contributed to the beauty of the city. The life of Kate Sessions is the subject of this program in the series 12 Who Shaped San Diego. I'm Peter Hamlin, and joining me as San Diego historian and chief historical consultant for these programs, Dr. Claire Crane. Claire, I think people listening to our series will notice a real change of pace on today's program. We've up to this time been talking about the discovery, exploration, and development of San Diego. We've seen the railroads installed. We've seen the streetcar system. Buildings are beginning to be built in the downtown area. And now we're looking at a woman, Kate Sessions, whose real strength and whose real contribution to the area was beautifying the city as a horticulturist. And so I see a real change in emphasis now that the city is really establishing itself as a city to things like beautification.
I would certainly agree with you about that. I think that her real role is that of having beautified the city through the introduction of particular kinds of plants and trees that do well in this soil and climate. She made a great study of that. And we certainly would not begin to have the kind of greening of San Diego that we think of as so characteristic if it hadn't been for Kate Sessions. This was just a pretty dusty, almost semi-desert area before the work that she started.
Elizabeth MacPhail is the author of the book Kate Sessions, Pioneer Horticulturist. And Elizabeth MacPhail says that Kate Sessions became an important part of San Diego soon after she arrived and became involved in the nursery business. But like many other great people, her career didn't follow a direct pre-planned route.
I think it was probably accidental, providential as far as San Diego is concerned. As a girl growing up in Oakland, she was very interested in flowers and horticulture, and she, at that time, it was a hobby of collecting flowers and drying them and pressing them, and she had her own little collection of dried flowers. But it wasn't until she graduated from high school in 1876 that she was given a trip to the Sandwich Islands, which we know of as Hawaii today, and that was a very unusual trip because people didn't go to Hawaii like they do today as tourists. But she went with some friends she was gone about 2 months, and during that time she saw the beautiful flowers of Hawaii, the beautiful trees, the palms particularly, and ferns impressed her. And when she came back, she thought how wonderful it would be if some of those beautiful flowers could be developed in California. But then she went to the University of California at Berkeley, and she studied and took the science course and then later a chemistry course. There was an agricultural course, but she did not enroll in that, obviously, probably because it was thought that it wasn't suitable for a woman. And when she came out of the university, she was prepared for nothing except teaching, as was the case in those days. Because she was a woman, why this, and had this education, why a teacher was about the only occupation that would be appropriate. And so while she had been in Oakland, she became acquainted with a friend, Rosa Smith, whose father happened to be on the school board in New San Diego. And in 1883, the Rust School, which was the main school in San Diego, the principal retired or wanted to resign, and the school board was looking for a new principal. So the Mr. Smith, who is a father of Rosa Smith, wrote to his daughter in Oakland and asked her if she could recommend anybody. And so she told several of her friends about the job and job opening, and Kate applied and was offered the job as principal of Russ School. Well, this, of course, was quite an important job for a woman to be a principal. And so she came down to San Diego not knowing what to expect because she had never been here before. And she probably was surprised at just the little village that it was, and if not quite discouraged. But what happened was, within a few months, the former principal decided to come back, and so she was demoted to vice principal. So she lasted as a teacher. She also taught as vice principal and teacher only for a year. She was unhappy teaching. She was probably a good teacher, but she just didn't care for it, and there were a lot of problems for the teachers, particularly with pay and working conditions. And then in 1885, she went up to San Gabriel to teach, and then while there, friends that she had made in San Diego decided to go into the nursery business, and they knew that she was interested in the flowers and in horticulture. And they wrote and asked her if she'd like to come back to San Diego and go into business with them. And this was just a wonderful opportunity for her. So she came down in 1885 and started her nursery with people by the name of Blaisdell. And then Blaisdell, when Coronada opened up in 1886, they bought almost a whole block of Coronada and set up a nursery there, and had their nursery. They broke up their partnership within a couple of years, and she carried on her nursery over in Coronada, and then had a little sales outlet for flowers at Fifth and C in San Diego. But that's how she got her start. It wasn't anything that she had planned for or that she had gone to school for, and it probably would have been the last thing on earth that she thought that she could ever actually do, but something that she really was glad and loved to do.
And in fact, Kate Sessions' interest in plants rapidly became an all-consuming passion.
Her whole life and her whole interest was in horticulture. She had no interest in anything else, unless it affected her plants or her trees. She just was not interested. In other words, her mind was blank as to everything except horticulture.
There's a nice poem contained in Elizabeth MacPhail's book about Kate Sessions. It's a poem that evidently Kate had copied herself into her scrapbook, and one that she must have loved. It goes like this. I long to dig and plant things in the spring, to feel the brown earth crumble in my hand, to hear life all around me wake and sing. The soul has roots, too, in the rich, dark land.
She really had a tremendous impact on the horticultural development of the city as a whole, and it's for her work in Balboa Park that she's been especially praised, and in fact has been popularly called the mother of Balboa Park.
Well, as far as the park was concerned, it was just nothing but a barren mesa, and it was her vision, but also George Marston's vision, that there could be a park development there. And so very early, even in the 80s, there were efforts to plant trees in City Park. The foresters had a day of planting, and school children on Luther Burbank's birthday would plant trees in the city park land. And then about 1892, she decided that it would be a good idea if San Diego would allow her to have her nursery in Balboa Park. The land downtown was getting too scarce so that she couldn't expect to lease any large amount of land in the downtown area, and it was getting too difficult transporting things from Coronado over to San Diego. So she prevailed on the city council to lease her some land in what was City Park. And so how they did it, they did finally agree to lease her 30 acres up in the up at the corner of 6th and Upas. And in order to really get around the law, they designated her as city gardener, because to lease to a private firm or for a private business, of course, would not be looked on with favor for city park land. And so her rent was she was to plant 100 trees in the park each year and make 300 trees available to the city in boxes, in crocks, that they could use for city buildings and schools and street planting. So that was the term, those were the terms of her lease. And she remained there northwest corner of the park up until 1903, for about 10 or 11 years. And many of the trees there in Balboa Park in that section are ones that were planted when she was there with her nursery.
Figuring that out, it comes to over 4,000 trees for a single person to plant. That's really quite an incredible accomplishment.
Well, yes, and of course, we're pretty familiar with the fact that Kate Sessions was responsible for a good deal of the planting in Balboa Park. But of course, these other trees, which were planted elsewhere in the city, they were planted in areas that were public, along the streets, for instance, or around public buildings such as schools and things of that sort. And she also helped to landscape many of the canyons in Mission Hills and that area. And we look at this and we think of it as being natural. But if you see some of the photographs that were taken around 1900 or in the early 20th century, it becomes crystal clear that those trees weren't there at all.
It's really hard to imagine, especially Balboa Park, in the days when it did not have the lush plant growth, almost none of it native to the park. And also it's hard to imagine without the buildings that are really a very familiar part of Balboa Park to us today. Sam Hamill came to San Diego in 1909, and he remembers the park at that time as being singularly unimpressive.
The park was a park in name only when we came. Sixth Avenue was dirt. There were very few paved streets. As soon as you got out of the central district, the streets were all just dirt streets. Few curbs, few sidewalks. Many of the sidewalks were wood. I can't say that I have any recollection of Balboa Park as a place where kids used to play, because where we built on Fern Street, all we had to do was walk one block east and we were in the same sagebrush, rabbit-infested hillsides that comprised Balboa Park.
Sam Hamill grew up in San Diego to become a successful architect, and he was involved in the reconstruction of some of the buildings that had been first built in the park for a great exposition that took place in 1915. And he remembers seeing that 1915 exposition as a boy.
I was only 12 when the exposition opened, so naturally I didn't see much of the design stage or even of the construction stage. When I saw it, it was opened with full flare and flags flying. But I was a curious little guy wandering around and trying to get free samples of things. Blackjack chewing gum was one that had a machine working. You could see it spewing out all of these little wrapped pieces of gum. I knew where everything free was in the park. And along with that, without my knowing it, I was exposed to real architecture, of which we had had very, very little in San Diego, practically none. I didn't realize at the time, but I was then being exposed to a cultural background pattern, which I now believe to be superior to any similar cultural group in Mexico or Spain. Mm. And yet it breathes the very essence of those two civilizations, and is something which I have striven all my life to sustain and retain, and which I hope others will now pick up and continue, as has been so wonderfully done in the rebuilding of the Casa del Prado.
The architecture is a reflection of our Hispanic heritage, and its origin has been discussed by many scholars. Sam Hamill finds the best analysis to be that of Eugene Neuhaus.
In Eugene Neuhaus' book, he gives a very careful analytical philosophic study of the background of the architecture, not only of our own exposition buildings, the 1915-16 group, but also of architecture in California. Many people called it mission architecture and other different things. He labels it more correctly as Spanish Mexican, which is better than Spanish colonial as a definitive name, because not all the colonies of Spain in any degree measured up to the great flourishing of architecture which occurred in Mexico itself. Mm-hmm. That was probably superior in many respects to the architecture of the period in Spain. In fact, the most prominent architects of Spain, because of the money being in the New World, they left Spain and arrived in Mexico.
Well, the first exposition resulted in the real development of Balboa Park, and I'm curious how that exposition came about. Why was it set up?
The Chamber of Commerce had discussed methods by which San Diego could put itself on the map, you might say, and make itself known as a tourist attraction. And specifically, finally in 1909, a banker, G. Aubrey Davidson, suggested that an exposition be held in San Diego to commemorate the completion of the Panama Canal, and that this would advertise San Diego as the first American port of call after ships had passed through the canal. The canal was due to be finished sometime around 1914-15. The construction, of course, had been underway ever since about 1904. And so the chamber and other interested citizens got together and began to raise money in 1910, initially put together about $1 million, privately subscribed, and then the city also floated bonds to do some of the buildings in the park. And that exposition was called the Panama California Exposition. There was a lot of rivalry between San Diego and San Francisco to obtain federal and state funding for this exposition, and the San Francisco finally won out in the competition and was named the official site, and it did receive much more money from federal and state government for its buildings. But the San Diego exposition then had to be scaled down somewhat, and perhaps that's one of the reasons that we have such a fine group of buildings. They concentrated instead of on a what most world's fairs always have been, and that's a lot of industrial exhibits. They concentrated instead on cultural and artistic exhibits, and they could do these in smaller spaces and didn't require the larger buildings that one does for showing how things are made and produced and so on.
Well, the style of architecture is really a symbol of San Diego in many ways. I think you've often said that the California Tower is really San Diego to a lot of people. And I'm curious how this particular style of architecture came to be established as the architecture for that exposition. How did the design for the park and its plan come about?
Well, that's a very interesting story. One of the men who was active in planning for the exposition was Charlie Collier, Colonel D.C. Collier. And Collier's idea was to have a little miniature Spanish colonial city and have all of the buildings look as if they were part of the same plan. And his initial idea was to have these buildings near where San Diego High School is now. He also thought that he thought of these in sort of simple terms, the what you might call mission architecture. And one of the outstanding authorities on Spanish architecture was Bertram Goodhue, and he was invited to come from New York and discuss with the committee how they might implement these ideas. Goodhue was a very, very charismatic personality, and apparently he just bowled over the committee and said, well, it will be much more attractive if the buildings are located across the canyon in more or less the center of the park and can be approached by a graceful bridge. Goodhue's idea also was to use a much more elaborate style of architecture instead of the simpler mission style with very, very plain walls. Goodhue wanted and was successful in getting the committee to agree to this more elaborate style, sometimes called Spanish Renaissance or Plateresque or Churriguresque. There are several different terms that are used for it, but it's a style of architecture that has a great deal of surface treatment, very elaborate decoration under the eaves, around doors and windows. The sculptured facade of the Museum of Man, for example, is like that of a cathedral. The idea for doing a group of buildings in the manner of a city apparently was Collier's, but it was Goodhue who really determined where they were going to be and that they would be in a much more elaborate style.
He immediately set to work and devised a more exciting setting for this complex of buildings. Very selected. He didn't devise it. God devised it. landscape architect who had participated in the first selection resigned forthwith, and we had a new landscape architect. Great Laurel Street Bridge was seen by many as a handicap, a dollar-consuming handicap, whereas to Goodhue, it was a great opportunity to capture one of the most exciting remnants of Roman civilization as it was left in Spain and Segovia, and is equally exciting throughout Mexico and Querétaro and other wonderful bridges and aqueducts of that particular type. Goodhue selected as his ground planner a man who later became very famous in his own right. That's Clarence Stein. Stein was recognized finally as the Dean of City Planners of the United States, and he was well recognized abroad, in England particularly. Clarence Stein died a few years ago, and we've lost a great man. Incidentally, his education was at the École des Beaux-Arts in Paris, and the Beaux-Arts was anathema to Goodhue. It's a miracle that Goodhue ever employed Stein in the first place. Here was Stein, a young Jewish boy, all apologetically hammering on Goodhue's door looking for a job. And I say apologetically because it was his meekness, his persistence coming back time after time on a weekly basis. He used to go in there, so Stein told me, says, "Well, now, do you have a job opening yet?" Finally, Goodhue asked him, "Well, what do you have there with you?" Stein had taken some of his proges from the École des Beaux-Arts and also a small notebook of sketches. Goodhue dismissed the proges of the École as not wanting to see them, but he said, "What do you have in your book?" These were sketches of small Paris churches in England, and Goodhue was so entranced with these that he employed Stein on the spot.
Well, and how about Carlton Winslow, who, as I understand it, designed a number of the buildings in along El Prado?
That's true. Carlton Winslow was a member of Goodhue's staff in New York. And Goodhue with the volume of work that he had, and with his center of operation being in New York, he sent Winslow out here as his representative. Goodhue retired from the later buildings after the California group mm-hmm. was designed, and that, by the way, was all designed in the office in New York. Mm. And Winslow was left with all the other buildings.
Claire, we've heard a number of names introduced to us, people that had been important to the early development of Balboa Park, its design, and I'm curious if that design for the first exposition was an important project in terms of, let's say, architecture, park planning, city planning, landscaping, things like this. Was it an important project in those terms on a national scale?
Yes, it certainly was, and one of the remarkable things about it is that the buildings were not only so well designed, but they have become loved by so many people that they were retained, even though many of them were only designed to be temporary. They were built of lath and plaster, and Goodhue himself recommended that many of them be demolished after the exposition, but they have been loved by so many people that repeatedly there have been groups of people have organized and saved the buildings time after time. And this is quite unusual when you look at other exposition sites, New York, Chicago, San Francisco, Montreal, many other places where there have been World's Fairs. They are a shambles after the a few years after the expositions are over, and many of the buildings are in fact torn down, and perhaps only a few left. We're very fortunate here in San Diego to have that original conception of this little city, an entire group of buildings of a unified architectural style. Unfortunately, we've had some intrusions so that they're not all of a unified style anymore, but that was the original intention, and to a large degree it has been carried out.
Sam Hamill and his partner Richard Requa were involved in reconstructing some of the old buildings for a second exposition in the 1930s. Many of the original buildings were not intended to be permanent structures. In fact, some amount of controversy has always surrounded the buildings ever since the suggestion was first offered that they be demolished. That was just after the close of the first exposition. At that time, a group of civic leaders got together and raised enough money to save the buildings. But that wasn't the last time they were in danger.
In the early 1930s, there was again discussion about tearing down many of those buildings in the park. This was due to a suit that was brought against the city of San Diego. One of the palm trees around Horton Plaza had fallen and killed a person, and her family then sued the city for negligence. And the city council became concerned that they might encounter similar difficulties because of the buildings in Balboa Park. So they were going to demolish them. And at that time, Gertrude Gilbert was the spearhead of a group of people who raised funds and, raised cane and raised funds in order to refurbish some of those buildings at that time. And they got estimates from Richard Requa and the contractor, Walter Trepte, that were under the estimates that the city had proposed. And so when they did get this kind of interest and involvement, then several of the buildings were strengthened and refurbished. And because of that, again, there was an idea that it would be a good thing for San Diego to have an exposition, and that this would, as the first one had, bring tourists, bring money, bring attention to San Diego. And so WPA funds were then obtained in order to refurbish still other buildings and to provide for the development of new buildings, which these are the buildings in the not along El Prado, but south of there, going down toward the Ford building. Most of those buildings were done for the 1935 exposition. And again, it did indeed help to pull San Diego out of the Depression, provide jobs for people, and put San Diego on the map as a lovely spot to come for tourists.
We mentioned that suggestions to demolish the exposition buildings, countered by strong civic efforts to preserve them, go all the way back to just after the first exposition, and the debate continues today. B. Evenson has in recent times been a leader in current successful efforts to restore several important park buildings, and she draws her inspiration from a previous civic activist who was similarly committed to saving the buildings. That was just before the second exposition. We mentioned the woman a moment ago. Her name was Gertrude Gilbert.
It was a time when the red tags were put on by the building inspector of that time. His name was Oscar Knecht. And all the buildings were to go down because they were built in this shoddy fashion, and they thought, well, we'll just clear that all. Even at that time, and this argument still goes on now, there was a little argument about passive park versus cultural center. But the cultural center was set at the time of the 1915 exposition when the Museum of Man was planned, I think. And then the other buildings after that had their cultural impetus. And we had this wonderful cultural center. It's unique in this, all these cultural centers and the San Diego Zoo and the Globe, they're all within walking distance of each other. They can all be improved, and that's what we should work on, having them finer and finer so it is something, so it's the finest thing in the world. It could be. It has the setting in the middle of a city, which is very unusual.
B. Evenson is in a long line of committed San Diegans who have devoted themselves to Balboa Park. With Sam Hamill, she founded the Committee of 100, a group that has been active in efforts to restore and preserve the buildings in the park. The name, the Committee of 100, is somewhat misleading, by the way.
Sam Hamill said one time that he was joking with B. Evenson when they formed the committee in 1967, and he thought that perhaps only 100 people would show up, and so it got that name then, the Committee of 100. Actually, it has probably about 2,500 or 3,000 members now. And they've been active for roughly 10 years. And in their literature, they have a very succinct statement, I think, of the significance of the buildings in Balboa Park. They say, "The 1915 Spanish colonial buildings in Balboa Park are the vestiges of the Panama-California Exposition. A miniature Spanish city was built with ornate old-world buildings, towers, fountains, plazas, arcades, and tropical gardens. Because of this great civic effort on the part of a small town of 40,000 people, the tourist industry was born, a depression was alleviated, and San Diego became a great naval base." So you can see from that very summary statement that the exposition played a tremendous role in San Diego's continuing economy based on the Navy and tourism.
Balboa Park stands out for a number of reasons. It's unusual in being such a large park so near the city's core, and it has a wide variety of different cultural resources within a very small distance of one another. Pauline DeGrange is the retired head of the Park and Recreation Department. She served with the department from 1941 to 1974. She points out that we owe a great deal to many people for the fact that we have such a resource for the city, going all the way back to the late 1800s when the land was first set aside as a city park.